Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Every morning I get into work and I scour the news of the day. Some days that feels like self-mutilation. To face the horrors of California's dwindling water, Antarctica's melting glaciers, Syria's massacred children, alongside the Republican Party's increase in military expenditures, the European Central Bank's $1.4 billion building, and the obscene amounts of Wall Street CEOs' bonus checks. Why is our world so upside down? Why, if we are the brainiest of living creatures, are we on a speeding train heading towards our collective doom with no noticeable prospects of slowing down and possibly surviving? We have relied on technology to save us, but in fact, technology has failed us. We have relied on religion to assuage us, but all God has overseen is injustice. We vacillate between denial and despair, but maybe we need to rethink our place in the world. My guest, Charles Eisenstein, has explored the pitfalls of what he calls the old story of control or separation and embarked on a quest to create a new story. Charles Eisenstein graduated from Yale in mathematics and philosophy. He's written several books, including Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition. And his latest book is The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. And he now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we seem to be in a period of transition worldwide, one that climate change has forced us to face, and our systems are unsustainable. We sort of know this in our gut. We sense this. We communicate today like never before. We're able to because of technology, but we're still isolated. Do you think this is a unique time in history, or can you sort of compare it to the other time we faced collective annihilation, like during, you know, the Cold War when nuclear weapons hung over our head?
Yeah, I think that we're kind of in a time that began then in the sense, like, nuclear weapons and climate change are similar because they're showing us that the solution isn't going to be to conquer the other. Nuclear weapons made it impossible ever to have final victory over our enemy, because what we did to them, we would be doing to ourselves, mutually assured destruction. Yeah. And the same thing is true now with climate change. Like, we're discovering what we do to nature, we can't escape it. We can't engineer a way out of it. We can't insulate ourselves from it. What we do to nature, we're doing to ourselves.
Do you find that people get overwhelmed by the world? Is there the sense of despair that paralyzes us from taking sometimes even the smallest action?
Yes. Next question. yeah, and I think partly despair is built into our basic worldview, you know, that fundamentally says that we are separate beings in a world of other, and therefore not much you can do is going to make a difference. Plus, we have a worldview that says change happens by exerting a force, by exerting your power. And in the story that we live in, the power is in the hands of the people who are doing all the things you listed at the beginning. They have the guns, they have the money, they have the surveillance state, they have all of these things. So what hope is there if we accept that change happens in the way we've been taught?
Yeah. Earlier in the month, we did a story on antibiotics and how when they were first invented, antibiotics were seen as this miracle cure that helped, save people from horrible bacterial infections. Millions of lives were saved, and it was seen as this technological wonder of our age. Now we're realizing there was a price to pay for the use and the overuse of antibiotics, and, you know, we're losing our microbiomes. It may be what's behind so many of our modern illnesses. And is that an example of how we as humans just aren't equipped, it seems, to foresee the consequences of our actions? And do we need to change our mindset to understand that every action we take, even if it seems positive right now, will have a reaction that we just need to be prepared for somehow?
I think part of the problem, I mean, with antibiotics, that approach to solving a problem, disease, for example, is based on linear thinking. You know, here's the proximate cause. It's a bacteria. Why are you sick? It's a bacteria. So kill the bacteria, you've solved the problem. And that works sometimes. But when the bacteria isn't actually the problem, but maybe a symptom of a deeper problem, then that approach doesn't work. Same with agriculture. When you see the weeds or the insects as the problem, the solution is obvious.
Right.
Kill the weeds, kill the insects. But what if weeds and insects are a symptom of something deeper, like monocrop agriculture? Or what if you think that the terrorists are the problem, so the solution is to kill the terrorists. The enemy is a problem, so the solution is to kill the enemy. So this is all part of the...
Crime is a problem, let's lock people
lock them up.
I mean, we could have example after example.
Right, and so really the transition is into systems change, where we realize that any one thing mirrors everything else. And that, anything we do is going to have effects everywhere. Yeah. And as long as we understand that, I mean, I'm not saying, well, therefore we shouldn't do anything because we can't predict it. But we have to understand that the world is not linear and therefore not controllable in the way that we thought it was.
For our Southern California audience, I want to mention that Charles Eisenstein is going to be speaking tonight at the Armory Center for the Arts in Pasadena at 7 p.m. So I'm sure some in our audience are thinking, well, isn't activism the answer to fixing the world? Don't we have to organize from the bottom to hold powerful elites accountable? Isn't that what can give us meaning? What can help guide our narrative of the world?
Well, I mean, obviously nothing's going to change if we don't take some action.
Right.
I think, though, a lot of activists are realizing that the kinds of actions they've been taking habitually and are kind of habitual responses to problems are themselves part of the problem. So, for example, the mindset of conquest. Well, how are you going to change society? Well, you got to conquer the bad guys. That doesn't work if you don't have enough force to conquer the bad guys. And then what happens when you realize that the so-called bad guys are, like, you have to include yourself in that category because we're all complicit. And then you look at revolutions, that those rare ones that succeeded in overcoming the perpetrators, but then the revolutionaries became themselves the new perpetrators. So I think a deeper revolution is necessary, not just in our ends, but also in our means.
So you write in your book about finding a story, rejecting the old story because it just isn't the right one for us. Why is it important for us to find a narrative to fit ourselves in this world? Why do we, you know, is it something that makes humans feel unmoored if we don't have a story to define our existence?
I mean, yeah, you could even say that human beings are the meaning-making animal. Not to say that there's maybe not a time to, you know, come into immediate experience, embodied experience outside of story. But if you want to create anything in the world beyond the power of your two hands to create it, you have to enroll other people in a story that organizes human activity and creativity. The right is very good at this, at telling a story. When you tell the right story, then people's actions naturally come from that story. The crisis of our time is in part a crisis of our stories or our myths. When I was growing up, the old story in its political expression was still really strong. You know, America, land of the free, home of the brave, and bringing freedom and democracy to the world, or science creating a better and better world.
And that, of course, might have been unique to the community that you came from. For example, people in other communities might have had a different story and a different vision of what America
was. But now, even among the privileged classes, that story is wearing thin.
Yeah. Your book subtitle is The Vision and Practice of Interbeing. And I want to quote from your chapter called Cynicism, where you open saying, I would like to speak to those of you who feel triggered by the principles of interbeing I laid out earlier, which I admit smack of New Age puffery. Actually, let me be brutally honest here. I only use the phrase New Age puffery as a way to implicitly assure you that I'm no dupe of such a thing, that I'm on the side of the hard-headed realists. See, here I am joining you in derision. Charles, I admit that I did feel the same derision. You then go on to say the derision of the cynic comes from a wound of crushed idealism and betrayed hopes. So I'm a cynic with betrayed hopes.
Yeah, and so am I. the principles of inner being, you know, there's a whole list of them, including things like the world outside of ourselves has the qualities, the properties of a self. That we're not just the only sentient beings in a world of other, that we're all interconnected, that what we do to the world, we do to ourselves, that anything that happens in the world is happening to us.
Every action has a reaction.
That every action has cosmic significance. And this is something that we can feel. You know, when a species goes extinct, when you read of these terrible things happening, why does that hurt? Yeah. Is it because you're making some implicit rational calculation that says that that's going to harm your rational self-interest?
Of course I do. When the wolves go extinct, right. I know that that, right. No, you're right.
So it hurts because it's happening to us because we're not separate. And that's something that every child knows. Every child knows that he or she lives in a world that's alive. And every child knows that their gifts are important and that the things that they do matter. But we've been brought up inside a narrative or even a mythology and a system, an educational system, a money system that denies the sacredness of the world, that denies the significance of our actions. And that hurts.
Well, what you seem to be describing is religion, isn't it? I mean, we have, for as long as humans have had, the ability to have recorded language, we've developed religions, we've developed stories to find a place for ourselves. There are more atheists than ever before. I count myself among them. Religion seems to have little meaning. We tend to trust not necessarily science, but at least the scientific method of questioning. I certainly do that. As the people pass judgment on science, saying it's brought us nothing but trouble because science helped us create the bomb. But it's simply a mode of inquiry.
Okay. Yeah. So what I'm saying does sound like, religion or spirituality. But see, what happened was when our deep narratives took sacredness and meaning away from matter, then religion responded by saying, okay, yeah, science, you're right. But there's this other thing called spirit that brings the property of sacredness back into matter. But that's actually part of the same ideology. And it's not the beliefs that indigenous people had. They didn't believe that there was a separate thing that brought sacredness to the world. They believed that the world was sacred through and through. Science.
So the idea of a God looking up, right. Looking down on us from up high, yep. Different from seeing trees and nature being infused
right.
with some level of importance, at least the same level that we might put humanity on.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask a child, what's it like to be that tree? That's not a ridiculous question for the child.
Yeah.
The child and the indigenous person live in a world where trees have an experience of being. Science is not only a method of inquiry, it's also a set of ideologies, it's also an institution. And it has metaphysical assumptions that are very much like a religion. And it has a priesthood too, very much like a religion. For example, the assumption of objectivity, that there's an objective world outside of ourselves that can therefore respond to our inquiries in a stable way over time.
Absolutely. Scientists get moved by their own biases constantly, which leads to years of bad science, and we see that over and over again.
Right.
But there is the ability to correct it. There is a correcting influence, peer reviewing, and eventually old paradigms get shifted. But at the same time, as somebody, I have a background in science, I actually met several fellow scientists who were deeply religious too, which is also really interesting when people can hold those things in their heads together, and there's nothing wrong with that. I wanted to come back to what you were saying about seeing the world and other sort of living parts of the world as part of our, as having greater importance. I mean, you're not just talking, I'm assuming, about sentient beings, right? I mean, the grass and the mountains and the rocks. Some people see that and they feel that if they would just stop eating animals, stop wearing leather, that they're respecting the world. But are we? I mean, we rely on one another. We feed off of each other.
Yeah. When we begin to invest beingness and beings beside ourselves, the first step is to say, well, the people that we've dehumanized, the other races, the other cultures, they are equally human. They are
right. We haven't even done that as a
right.
As
we're
a
still
species.
Working on that one,
yeah.
Right? But then the next step might be for the animals, because they're less like us than other people. But it's not too big a stretch to invest them with beingness and sacredness too. And then maybe the next step is to do that for plants. Even though they don't have a central nervous system. If you ask indigenous herbalists, how did you guys gain your herbal knowledge? They all say the same thing. The plants told us. And then you could go beyond that to rocks, to water, to mountains, to the planet itself.
Okay, so now we're coming back to I don't mean to insult you, but sounds like New Age puffery.
Right, right. And that kind of, but see that, that's a kind of epistemological imperialism that says that, we've risen above those primitive beliefs, just as we've economically risen above them. And so we go around the world in the mindset of development and say, we're going to teach you how to live. We're going to bring our ways to you. You're going to, you know, have work for wages. You're going to have a centralized infrastructure. And this is what the World Bank and the IMF have been doing for decades. Well, the same pattern says not only do we know better how to live than you, but we also know better how to know than you. Our bodies of knowledge and our ways of knowing are superior to yours, and your course of development is going to be to adopt our ways of thinking. And I think that that whole approach, all of these facets of development, are in crisis because we look around us. You know, 50 years ago, you could kind of persuade yourself that we were on the right course. But now, it's impossible to believe that. And so our culture is reaching this failure of our mythology, of our stories, that goes beyond just our technology and economics, but it goes to our whole worldview. And we're coming to this moment of doubt, where, and therefore of humility, where we're going to we're investigating other belief systems, not as these cultural curiosity objects, but from the place of, wow, maybe we don't know. So I think.
But when you say other belief systems, I mean, certainly there have been Americans and people in the West for years that have gone to find themselves in the East, the eat, pray lovers among us.
Right.
And honestly, you know, someone who comes from the East, I just find that kind of sad.
Right. Because there's also a lot of cultural appropriation going on and a lot of reaching for identity. You know, our identities are falling apart. So, oh, maybe I'll, you know, adopt a Sanskrit name. You know, maybe I'll get my, you know, this lost sense of identity that comes from our stories from somewhere else. So I think this is part of...
It's a search. It's a sense of people searching. You write in your book how many of us are in pain. We know the world is a painful place. And dealing with the pain of knowing the world is deeply wrong and not having a solution, is that the reason for trying to develop a story? And also, I think you're clear in your book that you don't have that new story, that we're sort of in between stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the part of the old story would be the expert coming and telling everybody how to do things and saying, here's the solutions. I don't think we're in
you're
a place.
You're not the expert.
Yeah. I don't think that I don't think anybody knows what the solutions are. I mean, I wrote a whole book on economics, a lot of nuts and bolts stuff. You know, it's.
You went to Yale. You must be an expert.
Right. But you know, none of those, like, I think that the systems that are going to emerge in the future are things that no one knows today. We get little glimpses here and there, but no one's going to, the way that our transition is going to happen isn't that somebody's going to have the master plan and convince everybody else, yeah, this is the most brilliant way to do it. I've mathematically worked it out. We're going to go through a period of chaos and emergence, the breakdown of the old, the space between stories, and the emergence of something new.
Do you get asked often, what is the solution to world problems? And then is that question itself part of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's just what I was just saying, you know. Yeah. But I think that part of this emergence comes, you were mentioning pain, you know. Yeah. We have all this unprocessed pain from what we, the dominant culture at least, but through our own complicity, have done to the world. Like, there's a lot of horrible things happening out there. And when we are shielded from that behind whatever systems of rationalization and obliviousness that we have, when we're shielded from that, that doesn't actually keep the pain out.
Yeah.
It still hurts, but it's diffuse. We don't know why it hurts.
Yeah, a lot of people just say, I'm just going to turn off the news. I can't hear it. It's too depressing.
Right. Or you know, you'll engage in some addiction or, you know, anything.
Self-medication, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, anything or entertainment, you know, anything to keep
or
the pain.
Or organized religion or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's when we actually feel that pain, feel the grief, then we know why it hurts. And then we can act more with greater clarity and less inner conflict.
What you just described sounds like less clarity to me. I mean, you know, as I mentioned when we started this show, reading the news and having to read the news as part of my job every day feels like self-mutilation.
Yeah.
And, you know, so far I haven't engaged in addictive behavior, but, you know, I do art or whatever. I cook. I try to find forms of therapy. But it's still not a solution to fixing the world. But I understand that even that idea of a solution to fixing the world is the wrong approach. And so we feel unmoored.
Yeah. And sometimes one of the escapes is to engage in habitual actions that aren't actually doing any good. Mm. But at least you get to tell yourself that I'm part of the solution.
Hmm. Gardening, habitual actions.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think that gardening isn't coming from, like, there's no rational way that you can say that gardening is actually going to, you know, help all these problems in the world. I mean, you could make some kind of contorted case, you know, that you're doing some incremental amount of reduction of CO2 or something like that. But really, like, that's not why you're gardening. Hmm. You're gardening because you love it, because it nourishes you. That's a deeper kind of revolution.
Well, let's end on the idea of love. Thank you very much, Charles, for joining us today. And best
thank
of
you.
Luck.
Thank you.
My guest, Charles Eisenstein, is going to be speaking tonight at the Armory Center for the Arts, and he is the author of The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. His event is at 7 p.m. This is Uprising.